Welcome to a special episode of The Political Scene. I'm Evan Osnos from The New Yorker. As the January 6th hearings have taken place over the past 6 weeks, I've been meeting with my Washington colleagues, Jane Mayer and Susan Glasser, to talk about the revelations and what it all means. Jane, Susan, we are here again. How are you both doing?
Great. Glad to be with you.
Yeah. Actually, big night last night. I'm looking forward to talking about it.
Yeah, we have quite a lot to cover here. Thursday's hearing, it focused on this very specific period of time on January 6th, 187 minutes, as we've been told, on the afternoon of the riot. And that was a period of time in which Donald Trump refused to call off the attack. What did we learn last night about what happened during those crucial 3 hours? What new details came to light that you think are important? Jane, why don't you go first?
Well, the principal point of the evening was to show that Donald Trump did nothing when he could have called off that mob. And it did, a terrific job in showing that he did have command control and that many people around him, including his own members of his own family and his top staffers, the lawyer for the White House and others, begged him to do something to stop as this mob turned violent and attacked the Capitol, and he didn't want to. I think the main point to me, or the achievement of the evening, was showing that he had a understanding of exactly what was going on. He was cognizant. It sort of goes to this issue that we've talked about before of mens rea. He knew what was happening, and he chose deliberately to let it keep going.
Susan, what about you?
Yeah, no, I think Jane just made the point that Adam Kinzinger, who was one of the main presenters last night, one of the two Republicans on the committee made, he said, I think this was the key quote of the evening, Donald Trump did not fail to act. He chose not to act. And I think that's really important. And, you know, look, obviously, one of the challenges of these hearings is the balance between revelation and storytelling. And did we already know that Donald Trump failed to act until he tweeted out a video of himself telling his people to move to go home? Absolutely. We already knew that. In fact, we knew that in real time. We were all watching the evidence of Donald Trump essentially abdicating his role as commander in chief as the Capitol was overwhelmed. So on the one hand, we already have known that. It was also the subject, and it was actually at the core of the impeachment case, the second impeachment case against Donald Trump in the weeks after he left office. And yet at the same time, the accumulation of detail, the sworn testimony shown on video and in person of his aides, his family members even, his advisors, his White House counsel, there's a power in that. And this is the first time we've seen those people narrating what actually happened on that day.
I do think, to your point about detail, that one of the lessons of this whole hearing process has been, you know, what we say in writing is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug, which is just the extraordinary vivid quality of these pieces of audio, these pieces of video. They really do have an extraordinary documentary power that I think does take us into a completely new territory in terms of not just saying the broad contours. Okay, we know that Donald Trump was in effect doing nothing during that period, but knowing exactly what he was doing. And then, I mean, and I'll ask you in a moment what you both thought was the moment that jumped out at you most. For me, I have to tell you, watching these outtakes of videos that Donald Trump was trying to tape, that there is this extraordinary moment where Donald Trump is trying to get the words out, literally say the words, the election is over, and he can't do it. He stops the taping and says, I won't say it.
Filed, right? See, I can't see it very well. Okay, I'll do this. I'm going to do this. Let's go. But this election is now over. Congress has certified the results. I don't want to say the election's over. I just want to say Congress has certified the results without saying the election's over, okay?
But Congress has certified. Now Congress has certified.
Yeah, right.
Now Congress
I didn't say over, so let me see. Go to the paragraph before.
I don't know how you get a more evocative, specific demonstration of his state of mind.
It was a perfect distillation. I think, actually, Susan, I saw that you tweeted that it might be Trump's epitaph, saying, basically, I don't want to say the election is over. I have to say, there's a certain amount of disbelief that has to be overcome in handling this story. It is such a shocking tale in our history. And so just seeing the minute details and having people under oath, I think it just breaks down that wall of disbelief. For me, I think that the thing that I had a hard time believing early on, that Trump might really willfully wish harm to his vice president, to Mike Pence. And for me, I think one of the most shocking details was the tape of a security official in the White House relaying what he had heard the security officials around Pence, his Secret Service detail, radioing. And what they were doing was they were sending final wishes to their loved ones because they feared they were going to die. And that shows you just how unbelievably dangerous this was, that it was that close, that they thought that there might be a successful assassination of the vice president.
Yeah, that was absolutely probably one of the most significant new pieces of information that was shown, both the audio and the testimony that the committee received from this anonymized former national security official, which was likely, by the way, someone who was working in the Situation Room. That Situation Room is kept manned inside the White House 24 hours a day. There are, you know, as we heard in the hearing last night, encrypted secret chat groups in which the president's movements are documented down to the precise minute. Same with the vice president on that awful day. And so we were actually hearing, you know, what the nerve center of the American government and American national security was hearing. That was new. The video, we've seen in the past, the video footage of Pence being hustled down the stairs in the Senate and to safety. What we hadn't seen was portions of the video that they showed last night of the Secret Service agent trying to check out if it was safe.
Oh, they can't keep the building. Hold.
Turn that door up. If we're moving, we need to move now.
Copy.
If we lose any more time, we may lose the ability to leave. So if we're going to leave, we need to do it now.
Hearing the crackling of fear in the voices of those agents as they're communicating in real time, and they're being told by a woman who's you can hear the terror in her voice, and she says there are about five or six officers between the vice president and the mob. There's smoke there. We don't know what it is.
There's six officers between us and the people that are 5 to 10 feet away from me.
Standby, I'm going down to evaluate.
Go ahead.
We have a clear shot if we move quickly.
And essentially, it's left to the people on the ground to decide. They have seconds to decide. If we don't go now, we're probably going to be overrun. And who knows what's going to happen then? And that's the setup for these messages to loved ones saying goodbye, in effect. And then you see that footage of Pence being rushed out. They made the decision. It turned out the right choice. They did save the vice president. But that's how close of a call it was. And that's something I hadn't seen before. I found it to be chilling. And I think, to Jane's point, it underscores, the deadly seriousness of what just happened. And it's still so unbelievable 18 months later, because basically it was a hearing about the commander-in-chief of the United States abdicating the role of president.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and backing what could have been an incredibly violent coup. It was already violent enough as it was. But, you know, I have to wonder when, and it was unanswered, I think, when if the nerve center, as Susan put it, heard those radio calls, how much did Donald Trump know? I mean, if the people, the experts in his White House on security knew that the vice president was in mortal danger, was this relayed to Trump as he sat there in the dining room watching it all on TV? How, you know, we still, I have to say, there were still details that I want that we didn't get. And
what is it that you're looking
to know? You know, I had sort of wondered, you know, will we see Nero fiddling while Rome burns? You know, what's going to happen in that dining room? Is he ordering cheeseburgers? Is he, you know, who is he speaking to on the phone?
Well, as we've learned, there was ketchup on the wall at one point. Right. And we've learned, of course, that he was sitting at the head of the table. They painted this really vivid picture. Here he is. He's at the dining table. In his personal office, he is facing Fox News. It is in his direct line of sight. And they actually showed some snippets of what was being broadcast on TV at the time that he's sitting there. So you're seeing what he's seeing, which is
violence.
The violence.
Right.
And I think it's worth reminding ourselves in the previous hearings what we'd also heard, which is that he had been told that people in the crowd have weapons. And in fact, he had said in response to that, he told his Secret Service, take away the magnetometers, take away them, because, as he said in these fateful words, they're not here to harm me. He knew that there were weapons.
And he fantasized or even planned to be at the head of that mob marching up Pennsylvania Avenue. Yeah. And you have to imagine what he was imagining. He had some kind of plan to stop the electoral count.
Here's an interesting detail from our book that isn't out yet in September. But one of the things that really struck with me, Ivanka Trump testified to the committee, but they really didn't show much about her repeated entreaties to her father. And that's interesting. She obviously was a very cagey witness to the January 6th committee. But Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, repeatedly summoned Ivanka Trump down to the Oval Office that day. And one of the things that really struck Ivanka that the committee didn't mention, but that she told others, was that when Donald Trump is sitting there in his private dining room, which, by the way, was essentially the de facto headquarters of the Trump presidency. People don't realize this, but he didn't like the Oval Office or except as a show. And he did like that part of it. But basically, he spent most of every day sitting in that dining room, which is a small room, at that table, watching television and then tweeting about what he watched on television. That was literally how Donald Trump interpreted the job of president of the United States. So he's sitting there in that dining room. But what Ivanka Trump was really struck by, because she, of course, was also watching this whole horror unfold on television, was that Trump was behind. He was lagging. He must have left the office at some point or put Fox on hold. And so he was actually a few minutes behind in watching the riot unfold. And I find that to be so revealing. Here's this man who we have all the intelligence in the world, right? We have an entire national security infrastructure that's sitting in the basement. We now know, thanks to the committee, right? There's the guy in the Situation Room who's recording the vice president's movements down to the exact minute. You know, the entire national security.
Hearing the most panicked words in real time from members of the Secret Service, and here's the president watching television.
The mad president is sitting, and not only watching television, he's like a few minutes on tape delay. He's on tape delay.
We were discussing what we'd still like to know. I mean, I think one of the big missing pieces is what that conversation consisted of between the White House counsel, Pat Cipollini, and the president, Trump, because we know from the witness Hutchinson from the previous hearings that Pat Cipollini told her that if Trump went up to Congress, all kinds of crimes were going to be committed.
Yeah.
Did he tell Trump this? What was going on as he tried to convince Trump to call off the mob? Did he warn him, you know, you're in legal hot water, you could be held accountable if there's a murder, you could be, you know, we need to know this still.
That's legally meaningful. And, you know, I think Pat Cipollone as a figure in this process has been evolving. I mean, at one point he wouldn't testify, then later he's testified, but he is still withholding a few details on the argument that it's executive privilege. It strikes me he's trying to be a little bit pregnant here in the sense that he wants to play ball, he wants to be recognized by history as having come forward, but on the essential matter, Jane, as you just described, which is what did he say? What was the actual legal advice that he gave to the president? He hasn't said that. And that is, I think, Susan, do you agree? Is that a sort of piece of the dark matter that ultimately will be consequential?
Absolutely. And I was struck, as Jane was, with the sort of palpable reluctance still of Cipollone as a witness. If you notice, he's very quick to give essentially self-justifying statements to the committee in which he says, well, I personally thought this was terrible, or I personally was hoping for a different kind of tweet. But he has cited executive privilege in refusing to characterize his conversations with the president or what the president said to him. And those are at the essence of the matter. Fundamentally, it is not particularly relevant what Pat Cipollone's personal opinions are. And what we need to get at is the question of, was the president of the United States advised that his actions exposed him to legal culpability? And to even further, I have long thought that there is likely to be some kind of a written memo from Cipollone in the White House counsel's office specifically debunking Donald Trump's theory that he sought to impose on Vice President Mike Pence on January 6th. Remember that Trump was personally demanding that Pence take these wackadoodle theories of the law professor John Eastman and essentially single-handedly declare the election results, the Electoral College election results, null and void on the basis of this wackadoodle theory of John Eastman. We know that Pat Cipollone and the White House counsel's office objected to that theory. We know that they told Trump that. Cipollone has testified to that effect. What we haven't seen is there a piece of paper? Is there a written justification saying in black and white to Donald Trump, this is unconstitutional, this is illegal, and if you pursue it, you are in fact doing something that is illegal? And I think that if there is a piece of paper like that, that would be very important evidence that we have not seen.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
I want to zero in on another feature of the hearing the other night, which was interesting, which is there were a few pieces of really revealing video and audio, one of which was tape of Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy condemning the attack in real time, very clearly, and then juxtapose that against how they talked about it later. And then there was another piece, and really an indelible piece of the hearing, which was Josh Hawley holding his fist in the air, and then they isolated this piece of video of him sprinting out of the Capitol once he realized that he was actually under threat. I think there is a lot of significance actually to the strategy of using those pieces of tape. Jane, what did you make of it?
I've sensed pure vengeance from Liz Cheney towards and Adam Kinzinger towards their cowardly colleagues. They wanted to show that the Republican Party has become a cover-up and an enabling body for this lawlessness, and it captured it. I I wondered with the little Hawley snippet. What happened in the hearing room as soon as they showed it was the whole place broke up laughing,
erupted
looking at
in
him.
Laughter.
It
yeah.
did, and I think once you've started laughing at yeah. somebody who's so self-serious as Hawley was, and
yeah.
so pretentious
Agreed.
With his fist in the air like he was a revolutionary, you never see him again.
Agreed.
The
I
same
actually
way.
Think this is really a yoke on his political future because he was rendered ridiculous and hypocritical. And if he's seeking to present himself as this kind of brave figure, this is going to be very, very hard. I mean, Josh Hawley, in effect, got a nickname last night, which is he will now be the runner for as long as he's in politics. Susan, what do you think about this? How meaningful was that strategy?
Well, you know, look, there was an element of trolling the trolls, right? And in some ways, the entire Republican Party was trolling all of us with this. Josh Hawley knew full well that Donald Trump lost the election. And there's a real significance. It wasn't just empty performative BS of Josh Hawley raising his fist in the air, but actually Josh Hawley's objection on January 6th, and he was the first senator, along with Ted Cruz, to announce that he would object to the electoral results. If they had not agreed to do so, the entire coup plot would have faltered before it began on that day, because the way that the Electoral Count Act is written, it requires not only objections from House members, but that each objection to a state's electoral count must be joined by at least one senator. So if Josh Hawley had not started the ball rolling, and Mitch McConnell, by the way, Mitch McConnell was opposed to this ploy, and he begged the Republican senators not to go along with this madness. He said it will be the most destructive act in my career in the United States Senate if you do this. And they basically, you know, stuck a middle finger to the Republican leader as well in doing it. So Josh Hawley was actually a serious figure in the coup plot, number one. Number two, I do think you're right to look at this as this hearing as a sort of revenge play by Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, the two Republicans on the panel, are apostates now, unwelcome in the Republican Party. Between now and September, the next time when the committee is going to reconvene and hold more hearings, Liz Cheney is very likely to lose her Republican primary in Wyoming to a Trump-endorsed candidate who is running largely as Trump's revenge against Cheney. And I really think you have to look at last night's hearing in the context of largely a hearing convened by Republicans to force the rest of their party to, as I wrote in the column this morning, to wallow in their own dishonor. They are wallowing in the dishonor of the Republican Party.
Yeah, in some ways, I think it goes beyond vengeance to the point of actually trying to undermine these Trump facsimiles. I mean, that's what Hawley aspires to be, you know, as we're so often told, he wants to be the kind of smarter Trump. I think if you take the full experience of the hearing, you had a real emphasis on people who demonstrated leadership in their lives, military members like Congresswoman Luria and Congressman Kinzinger, both of whom served in the military, Matthew Pottinger, one of the witnesses, a former Marine officer. You had Liz Cheney quoting Margaret Thatcher in her final moments. There was a real effort to try to reclaim, in effect, leadership of the Republican Party, kind of pull it out of the jaws of the Trump phenomena. Whether that works or not, I don't know, but it struck me as having a kind of strategic intent.
Well, I don't think any of us know really whether it will affect the hardcore Trump supporters, but it's been interesting to watch polls that show that independents, in particular, have swung towards a much more positive view of these hearings. Okay. I think some poll I saw suggested that I think they'd gained almost 10 points in terms of approval from independent voters. So this may be, as you say, sort of snatching the narrative from the Trump camp into, out of the jaws of the Trump camp.
I want to zero in on one more detail, if we can. And that was, in some ways, the most effective witness last night was one that we never saw. It was an unnamed security official working inside the White House. We heard an altered voice and just these really extraordinary revelations, one of which we haven't talked about, which is that at a certain point in this process, this person was aware that White House lawyers, Cipollone and others, were actually saying to one another that the president doesn't want anything done, quote unquote. I mean, it's just a searing bit of language that he actually didn't take a call from the Pentagon. I mean, it's you have to pause on that for a second. I mean, the Pentagon is calling and saying the Capitol is being overrun, and the President of the United States refused to talk to him, and so Cipollone had to do it himself. I don't know how much more vivid you can get in terms of somebody abdicating their role as Commander-in-Chief at that point.
Completely shocking. I agree. And so the case was made for dereliction of duty, possibly for obstructing a federal governmental process. The question is what kind of accountability there might be.
I think that this question remains about what does accountability actually mean? And, you know, the Justice Department is continuing to investigate this 18 months after it happened. It's not at all clear that even if they come up with what they believe to be a full case against Donald Trump, that they would actually choose to pursue it. A former president has never been indicted in American history. That would be a decision with enormous consequences for Merrick Garland, the attorney general, and Joe Biden himself would have to be involved in that.
Jane, do you get the sense that today, compared to a few weeks ago, the chances of a criminal prosecution of a former president is substantially higher or not?
Well, we've heard from Merrick Garland recently, essentially saying, in some ways pushing back. There's been so much criticism of him online and elsewhere, suggesting that he's not doing enough. This is at least the sort of Democratic narrative about it. And he sort of pretty angrily almost for Merrick Garland, who's a very tamped down guy, sort of said, we will not conduct our investigation and show our deliberations in public. That's not what we do in the United States Department of Justice. But no man is above the law. And then he repeated it. No man is above the law, which seemed to indicate they have a sprawling investigation and that Trump is certainly not off the table as a target. You know, I mean, I'm struck when I sort of step back with how, I mean, it's a horrible idea in some ways or a prospect to have to go to the point where a former president might be prosecuted. It's a precedent that you can't set lightly. But what I was going to say is I'm struck by what a complete dereliction of duty it was on the part of the Republicans in the Senate not to impeach Trump the second time.
Yeah.
That's the process that really is set up for taking care of a wayward president like this.
Do you think, Susan, that if, as we've heard recently, Donald Trump tries to announce his candidacy for president in 2024, do you think that will have an effect on the possibilities of prosecution? How significant will it be if he announces? How do you think it'll be received?
Well, you know, Evan, it's interesting because I think Donald Trump thinks that it would have an effect and a deterrent effect, perhaps, and help protect him from prosecution. It's not clear that it will, but, you know, look, I'm very wary of engaging in punditry around future prosecutorial actions or lack thereof. You know, that just rarely works out well. And I have to say that, you know, it's been a year and a half, and it's I think, notable how slowly the Justice Department has proceeded. And, you know, opponents of Donald Trump have been waiting and waiting, looking for the silver bullet that never comes, that's going to finally, once and for all, knock him out of politics. And, you know, I would be wary of waiting for that as the magic thing that's going to end this Trump phenomenon.
As we wrap up here, I want to pose a question to both of you that I think kind of lurks in the background of so much of what we've been seeing, which is this question of what actually saved democracy on that day and in the fateful days around it when this coup was unfolding. Was it Mike Pence? Was it General Milley? Was it, in fact, the underlying institutional strength of the courts Or was it this strange scattered collection of individuals, people like the Secretary of State of Georgia? How do you put it together in your own mind as a way of understanding what defended the American system from this extraordinarily aggressive attempt to destroy it?
Well, it was all of those things, and it was our court system also, and our legal system and the rule of law. But the fact that it came this close, I think the other thing that really saved the Republic, really, was that Trump and his allies were such flaky, ham-fisted amateurs at conducting a coup. I mean, I think it shows you how fragile the system is, and if somebody tried with a little bit more experience and foresight, they might be able to do it.
Susan, what do you think?
You know, Evan, I actually have a different take. I don't think democracy was saved. I don't. I think that we're in an ongoing crisis. I think that what's notable is the weaknesses of the system that were revealed, and that certainly Trump and or his allies would use in the future. We turned out to be just one vice president, one attorney general away from even more unthinkable actions occurring. And I think that it's hard for us to process these events because they're so very unthinkable. But, you know, there's never really been any doubt in my mind from the very beginning. Now I think more people are coming around to this view that this was absolutely, you know, in the political science term of art, a self-coup attempt by Donald Trump to remain in power. That was the very explicit goal of the campaign. We saw him launch in a very calculated and deliberate way. We have not responded as a country with the seriousness that is required of having had a former president who sought to overthrow the constitutional order, who remains the leader of his party, who remains the popular front runner to return to office again, whether he chooses to run or not. And so I actually think that we're in the middle of the crisis. It's very hard to know exactly how it's going to turn out.
Well, I mean, I agree with that. I don't actually see that as a contradiction. But the system did hold. We do have a different president, but I think we've seen incredible weaknesses here that are incredibly dangerous. And there's never been any real accountability for this. That's the thing that is so frightening.
Well, it is at this point still very much a live matter, and there will be more hearings in the fall, and I think the three of us are going to keep talking about this either on a podcast or off. It is always a pleasure to be with you. I learn a lot from this, and thank you both for coming on.
Always great to be with you guys. The best.
Oh, it's fantastic. Absolutely.
This has been The Political Scene. I'm Evan Osnos. The show is produced by Michelle Moses and Kylie Warner, with special help today from Rhiannon Corby. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening.